Don read to us from Hebrews chapter 8 this morning. That is our scripture that serves as the foundation for our lesson today as we continue our series on a shadow of good things to come. Now that statement, a shadow of good things to come, actually comes out of Hebrews chapter 10, just two chapters after the one we read this morning. And we find another reference to a shadow of good things to come back in the book of Colossians. In each of those two places, in Colossians and in Hebrews 10, the writer is telling us that things that were happening in the Old Testament were a shadow of good things to come. Remember seeing in the movies, especially the ones that are supposed to be scary in some way, someone can hear footsteps and they know something or someone is out there, and then the light is just right and they can see a shadow moving across the wall even though they can't see what it is. But the shadow let them know something was there. Something was coming. And that's exactly the image the writer of Hebrews and Paul, the writer of Colossians, is trying to communicate to us. That when these things were happening in the Old Testament, they had meaning and significance all their own. But at the same time, God intended them to represent something still coming. Yogi Berra, who's a former baseball player and baseball manager and now advertises for an insurance company, Aflac, is known for saying things that sort of seem turned around in his statements. And one of the most famous of all of his statements is when something would happen to him, he said, it's deja vu all over again. Well, of course, the statement deja vu means something happening again. And so by saying it's all over again, made it somewhat nonsensical in a way. But that's what God intended, is for these people who had experienced these things and knew these things, that when Jesus came and they started seeing the unfolding of God's reality in Jesus, and then in what He did after He went back to heaven and the church began, for people to start saying, I've seen this before. I now recognize this. I now see that God was telling us long before that these things were going to happen, even though we didn't see it originally. And now today we move into another part of those shadows in the Old Testament. Remember in the Old Testament that as we begin in the book of Genesis, we just start out with Adam and then Eve. And then after they're cast out of the garden, they have a son named Cain and then a second son named Abel. And when those boys grew up to a certain age, God called on them to bring offerings to Him. And as Abel brought offerings from his flock and Cain brought them from the field, God accepted the offering of Abel, but not of Cain. And God told Cain that if you had done what I said, your offering would have been acceptable. There's been a lot of discussion over the years as the scriptures record that about what was wrong with Cain's offering. But fundamentally, it wasn't what God had asked for, even though we don't have God's exact words to them of what He did want. But as time moved on and that first family of man on earth grows and fills the earth, and then God destroys it with the flood in Noah's day, and then things begin all over again with a new family, the family of Noah and his descendants. Once again, that family grows and starts to cover the earth. Then one day God calls a family out, the family of a man by the name of Abram, who lived in a place called Ur of the Chaldees. Now, Ur of the Chaldees, that ancient city, is located somewhere south of where modern Baghdad is today. And yet that's where he came from. And God called him and his wife Sarai, and they travel to the place God gave them, which is into what today is called the Holy Land, that land around Jerusalem and modern Israel and where the Palestinians live and so forth. But God gave him all that land. And he had a son. And then he had two sons, and then one of those two sons by the name of Jacob has 12 sons of his own, and the family is growing, and God has designated this family as somehow special. In a time of drought and famine, God leads them down to Egypt, where one of those sons had risen to the position of second or third highest in all the kingdom of Egypt. His name was Joseph. And they settle down there And in God's providence, as generation after generation of them were there in Egypt, they grew and grew until finally they were a nation all their own, population of several million people. And they lived under the rule of the Egyptians, and finally the Egyptians turned them into the slave class, the working class of their nation. And so God determined to deliver them and take them back to the land He had originally given their ancestor Abraham. And so Moses was born. And God, through a series of miracles, finally breaks the spirit and power of the Pharaoh of Egypt, and He brings those people out. And that's when God made the real Ten Commandments movie. You know, they cross the Red Sea, and they come to Sinai, and God gives them the law at Sinai. But something else also happened at Sinai, and that's what we're going to be talking about this week and next week, is when God brings this mighty nation of people out of Egypt. They had never known what it was to be a nation before. They had always just been Abraham's descendants and had almost taken their identity from the Egyptians that had been there so long. But God brings them out, and He brings them across that Red Sea and down to Sinai. And there at Sinai, they come in contact with God, not just in the intellectual sense, not in the sense they somehow believed there was a God, but they came to realize there really was a God. Because the mountain shook, and there was clouds and fire and lightning and thunder, earthquakes, and God spoke, and they heard Him speak. And it frightened the people so much that they begged Moses to talk to God on their behalf and ask God not to speak to them anymore, because they were afraid just in hearing God speak, they would die. And so they asked Moses to have God speak to him and then have Moses speak to them. And while they were there receiving the message from God, one of the things that happened is that God gave them a new way to worship Him. You read that in the book of Exodus. It starts in chapter 20. It all starts unfolding. What we're going to do today is we're going to talk about that time and what God gave them. Then we're going to just talk briefly about what was missing in what God gave them. Then next week, with God's help, we're going to talk about how that foreshadowed Christ. But I think even now, as we talk today about what God gave them and what was missing from what God gave them, if you will think ahead, I think you'll start seeing already how these things were a foreshadowing of Christ. As God brings them to Sinai, the first thing that stands out in my mind, according to Exodus chapter 19, is that God was now making a new covenant with His people, He says, in Exodus 19 and in verse 5. Their covenant with God up until that time was based upon what promises God had made through Abraham. And those promises were not canceled or nullified, but rather now God was, instead of just having a relationship to Abraham and them having a relationship to God through Abraham, now God was going to have a relationship with them directly. And so He was establishing a new covenant with them at Sinai. Not only was it a new covenant, a new relationship between God and His people, at Sinai, God was going to give them a new law. We most often think of it just in terms of the Ten Commandments. But there were many more laws besides those. The Ten Commandments was the foundation and the basis and the core of what He gave them, but much more was given there. I've read different scholars and so forth. I haven't ever had the patience to do it myself, but different ones of them will say God gave them anywhere from 195 to 361 laws. Jewish tradition says God altogether gave them 361, one for each day in the Jewish year. So they got a new law at Sinai as well. They got new sacrifices. Until that time, from the days literally of Cain and Abel, the very first children of Adam and Eve, there had been sacrifices, and they were a kind of foreshadowing of what was going to come in the New Testament. And they seem to have continued to practice that very simple, basic form of sacrifice from Cain and Abel right down to Sinai. But now God gives them new sacrifices. They were specified, they were clarified, they were expanded upon. They had all sorts of different sacrifices, sin and guilt offerings, burnt offerings, thanksgiving offerings, peace offerings, wave offerings, grain offerings, all kinds of offerings that were brought in. New sacrifices came at Sinai. There was a new priesthood. Until that time, there was no unique group of people who were designated as the priest to go to God for the people and then to go to the people for God. But at Sinai, God instituted a new priesthood. It came from the descendants of the tribe of Levi. And at that time, the head of that family was a man by the name of Aaron, the brother of Moses. And so Aaron was designated as the first high priest, and his sons and direct descendants then would be the priest afterwards. And so a new priesthood came about there at Sinai. But something else also came. A new way and place to worship God. Until then, there had not been any specific way that we can read in the scriptures or even see that people practiced to worship God. But now God gives a very specific way and a very specific place where all this was to take place. And this place was called the tabernacle. That's the word the scriptures use. That word tabernacle in the Hebrew language can translate a lot of different things. Everything from tent to building to house, depending on the context. But it's clear that God intended for them to build a specific thing, and it was there that the center of their worship would be. It didn't mean that they could only worship God when they were there, but the very center of their worship was now there. And then all the ways and so forth, the holidays we've just finished up on, the sacrifices we just mentioned again, and all sorts of other things all centered around this tabernacle. And it tells us in the scriptures in Exodus chapter 26, as God is talking to Moses about this tabernacle, there's very detailed instructions. And it goes on from chapter 24 or 25 all the way up through chapter 40. Great detail about how it is built. God specifies the colors of the material, the kind of the material, how to make the posts that held up the fence that was around it, how to make every single thing in it. And at one particular point in all of that, as God is giving all this to Moses, he says this, Exodus 26 and in verse 30, "Set up the tabernacle according to the plan I showed you while on the mountain." The writer of Hebrews over in the New Testament, in looking back at that time, says twice in the book of Hebrews at least, that they made everything according to the plan or pattern. We understand that to mean today something like what we would call blueprints. Make everything according to the blueprints. God had given Moses, while he was up on Sinai, a kind of blueprint of what the tabernacle was to be like. God didn't just say, "Moses, make me a building of some kind. I don't care what it looks like. I don't know what you make. I don't care what you make it out of. I just want you to make me one." God didn't do that. God went to the other extreme, and he spelled it out to the most minute detail of how it was to be built. So clearly, this was important to God if he would spell it out in so much detail, even to talk about where they had gold rings that held up some of the curtains and the material that covered the main building itself. The first layer that covered the building was made out of a certain kind of fine linen that had woven into it, all through it, images of angelic beings. Then that was covered with another layer of something else entirely, then still another layer of something else still. It was all made according to a very specific blueprint, plan, pattern. And so what happened at Sinai was not just them receiving a new covenant and a new law and new sacrifices and a new priesthood, but a new place and way to worship God. And then something else very significant happened at Sinai. For the first time, God came down, and in this place they built for him, he put his presence to always be with them. Now just think for a moment. When we're going to get over to the New Testament next week, what we're hearing here, a new covenant, a new law, new sacrifice, new priest, new place and way to worship God. God being with his people when they do that. A shadow of good things to come. But now let's talk a little bit more about this place, this tabernacle that they built. As they built it, and I wish, you know, we've been through this a few years ago in our Sunday morning class when we came through Exodus studying this, so we just have to remind ourselves now of what all we read there. We know that God had them build this in such a way that it was portable because they were living in a wilderness area and they were a nomadic people. And for the next 40 years, they're going to be traveling about through this wilderness, wandering until God at last will take them into the land of promise. But in the meantime, every time they went from one place to another, this thing had to be picked up and taken with them. And God actually had it designed in such a way it was portable. It could be torn down, folded up, carried on the shoulders of men and on carts to the next place. And then special men whose job generation after generation was to take care of this then would reassemble it and put it back together, and there it would be. And God's presence would travel with them in a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, as they did. But when this thing was set up, you start out with an outer fence that surrounded the whole thing. It was made according to the pattern. And then when you got inside of it, one of the things you saw in there was an altar of sacrifice made according to the pattern. A place where sacrifice was made to God. Sacrifice could not be made outside that area. It had to be made inside and only on that altar. Something else that was located in there very near the altar was a large basin filled with water. It was called the basin of washing. Or in the old King James Version, it was called the bronze laver. But it was a large basin filled with water that was, the priest always had to wash themselves, their hands and their feet, before they could serve before God. I just can't resist right at the moment. Have you ever wondered why the night before he was crucified, when Jesus was with his disciples, why he washed their feet and told them that's all that need to be washed? Because in the old system, in order for a man to serve acceptably before God, once he came into the area where the service was taking place, he went to the basin of washing and washed his hands and his feet. A shadow of something else to come. But then there in the very middle of this compound, there was this altar and this basin of washing, but then there was a building. It was the tabernacle proper. And it had certain dimensions and was covered in certain ways, had pillars up supporting the front of it and inside of it and so forth. But as they went in the front entrance of it, you first entered into what was called the holy place. A holy place. And inside of that first room of this building were located several items. Not even discussing what was covering the walls and the ceiling and the floor, but the items that were located inside of the holy place were, among other things, first of all, a golden lampstand in which oil was kept burning all the time in the seven branches of this, what today we call a menorah, the seven-branched lampstand. In addition to the lampstand was a table called the Table of the Showbread. And this table had on it 12 loaves of bread, one for each of the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 families that made up this nation of Israel who were now in this new covenant relationship with God. And that bread was changed out regularly with fresh loaves of bread. And it signified, as it tells us in the scripture, that God was always taking care of his people. That symbolically, those 12 loaves of bread represented the fact that God fed his people every day. And we know that literally he did during that wilderness wandering, that every day they had manna come down from heaven. And they called it later on bread from heaven. But when it first started appearing for them morning after morning, they called it in the Hebrew language manna, which means, what is it? May not be theologically very deep, but it lets us know they didn't know what it was. Later they referred to it, though, as bread from heaven. Also located in that holy place, in addition to the lampstand and the table of the showbread, was a smaller altar, not made for the sacrifices that took place outside of the building, but a small altar upon which incense was burned continually. And so the room was continually filled both with the smoke of the incense burning and the odor of it. And they had to burn only a certain kind of incense. God gave exactly the mixture and the kind of materials that went into that incense. And they could only use that. And they could only use fire that came from coals that were taken from the altar outside in order to burn that incense in there on the altar of incense. Very early on, we know there was an incident in which two of Aaron's sons took fire from somewhere else to light the fire of the incense, and God immediately struck them dead for it because God had already told them to do everything according to the plan and the pattern, and they were not doing it. But then at the back of this first room was a curtain that hung from floor to ceiling and from side to side, and it completely shielded their eyes and separated them from what was behind that curtain, which was called the Holy of Holies, or the Most Holy Place. This veil separated them from it. And only the high priest, only once a year, when it was set up, was allowed to go behind the curtain and into that most holy place. And what was inside of there? Only one item, fundamentally. Something called the Ark of the Covenant. This was a box, an oblong box that God had Moses build, again, according to the pattern. It was all out of wood and then laid over completely with gold. It had rings on either side so long poles could be passed through on either side so they carry it by the poles and not touch it with their hands. You could only carry it by the poles. The lid of this box, this ark, flat top, gold-covered wood, had on top of it mounted two angelic beings. Two cherubim had been made out of gold and mounted there on top of it. And they both looked to the middle of that lid and looked down at the spot in the middle on the top of the lid. And that spot on top of the lid in between those two cherubim was called the place of mercy. The mercy seat. It's the place where once each year the high priest was allowed to come in with blood from the offerings and sprinkle blood there on the mercy seat and ask for forgiveness for himself and for his people for their sins. And then inside of the Ark of the Covenant were three items. The two tablets of stone on which were written the Ten Commandments. These were called the tables of the testimony, but they were stored inside of the Ark of the Covenant. And along with them was a golden vessel filled with manna that they had gathered back when God first started giving them manna in the wilderness. And then the third item in there was actually the rod that Aaron carried with him. It's presumed by me that this is the same rod that when he stood with Moses in front of Pharaoh, that when he cast it down, it would turn into a serpent and swallowed up the rods of the magicians of Pharaoh. But then later, while they were in the wilderness, there was a certain time when God had it bloom. I mean, it was made out of almond wood. And on a certain day, God just had it suddenly branch out and put out leaves and then blooms. And then those blooms turn into the fruit of the almond tree, which is nuts, and bring to maturity, all while people just watched it in a few minutes there. And so from that time forward, it was always referred to as Aaron's rod that budded or bloomed. God did that to remind his people that though they were like a dead stick, I mean, they were a nation without a land, it looked like a dead end for them, that God was going to make them live. And that was stored inside of the Ark of the Covenant. All these items, all these things having to do with the holy place and what was in it, the most holy place, what was in it, the Ark of the Covenant, and what was in it, all turns out to be shadows of what's still to come. And then when all this was assembled, all of it was built, and it was prepared, and the last chapter of the book of Exodus, as they're ready now to begin this new covenant relationship with God and worship God acceptably at this new place he's given them, the last thing that had to be done was then all of it was anointed with oil and consecrated to the service of God. Again, that will turn out to be a shadow of something else still to come. So that's what they had. That's what they were given. Now, what was missing in all of that? You'd think at first, if God directly had a hand in doing all of this, designing it, planning it, overseeing it, even punishing those who didn't follow the plan, that, I mean, you'd have to say, at least in some sense, it's perfect if they followed the plan. And it was. But God purposely left some things out. God purposely did some things in all of this that by them missing were shadows of what was to come. We find those things being talked about mostly in the book of Hebrews. As we look then just very briefly into the book of Hebrews, here are some of the things we read there. First of all, in Hebrews chapter 4, the Hebrew writer tells us that even though all of this happened at Sinai and God was taking them to a land of promise and a land of rest, when they got there, they never actually had rest that God intended or that God envisioned for them having. So the first thing that was missing was the true rest that they were looking for. Yes, they were given the land. They were given homes and places of abode. They were made into a nation, and we're in the middle now on Sunday morning studying out the history of that nation as it divided and became two and all that. But something fundamentally was missing. In the Sabbath days he had given them, the Sabbath day talked about rest. It was a day of rest. It was a shadow of something still to come. But they didn't get it when they went into the land. Even while they were in the land, they would enjoy a little peace for a little while. Then there would be war and there would be conflict. There would be falling away from God and then God having to bring them back to him and so forth. They never had the rest. It says in Hebrews 4 that was the case. They never had rest. And so in Hebrews 4:9, the writer says, therefore still remains a rest for the people of God. So that's one thing that was missing. That all of these things, as perfect as they were in that they came from God, something that was missing, they never in and of themselves actually reached the ultimate goal that God had for his people. Secondly, this priesthood that God set up for them was imperfect. The priesthood in one sense was perfect in that God designated who it would be and all the things about it, and they followed that to the letter of the law. But there was a fatal flaw in all of it. This priesthood was made up of imperfect men. Men who always, before they could offer sacrifices for the sins of the people, always had to offer sacrifices for their own sins and ask God to forgive them before then they could be considered holy enough and worthy to ask God to forgive the people. And so it says in Hebrews 5:3, that it says that these priests had to offer sacrifices for his own sins as well as for the sins of the people. There's another flaw in the priesthood. Not only were they sinful, imperfect people, they died. They didn't serve forever in that role of God's spokesman to the people and the people's representative in seeking God's favor. They died. In fact, they even specified in their law that a man couldn't become a priest until he reached a certain age. And when he reached another certain age, he was forced to retire. He couldn't serve after that time. Because it was an acknowledgement that they were going to die and be replaced with others after them. So that was something else that was missing. It was a permanent priesthood, but there were no permanent priests. They died. And then again, as the Hebrew writer tells us in Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 5, as wonderful as this place was, the tabernacle, and later in the Old Testament, we've already come to and passed that again in our Sunday morning class, God then had them build a temple, which was a bigger, more elaborate, even more permanent form of the tabernacle. But what was missing in all of that was this. It was not the real thing. Yeah, it was a real tabernacle. It was a real temple. But it was only a copy of what was in heaven. Wouldn't you be disappointed if you planned with your family a big trip to go to Washington, D.C.? And when you get there, they show you, the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial and all of that. And then on the last day, they said, oh, by the way, you need to know that our government, in order to protect those valuable historical monuments, have actually replaced those with just copies. And what you actually saw was just a copy of the Washington Monument, and a copy of the Lincoln Memorial, and a copy of the Vietnam Wall. Think you'd be disappointed a little bit? I think so. And yet, that turns out to be that the tabernacle was only a copy of the true place to worship God that was still in heaven. And as wonderful and glorious as it was in its own right, it was only a copy of something far more glorious. And then there was the veil. The veil was real, and they made it as God told them to. But the veil was telling them that something was missing. What was missing was open and free access to the presence and grace of God. There was a curtain in between them and Him. A shadow of something still to come. And then there was the blood of all those sacrifices. They were just what God told them to do. And God told them that when they did it, that He would forgive them of their sins. But then the Hebrew writer tells us, and we need to realize his first readers were actually Jewish people just like him, who knew this far better than we understand it today, that the fact that when they made those sacrifices one day, what did they have to do the next day? Make them again. And the next day, make them again. And the next day, make them again. 361 days a year, which is how many days there were in the Jewish calendar. Every day they had to make the same sacrifices. And once a year, every year, the high priest had to go into that most holy place and make that blood sacrifice. Why? What was missing was true, once and for all, forgiveness of their sins through those offerings. They were just exactly what God gave them to do. And yet they did not ultimately, in and of themselves, accomplish the purpose. Why? Because they were a shadow of something else coming. They could never take away sins. As it says in Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 13 through 15, the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkled on those who are ceremonially unclean sanctify them so that they were outwardly clean. How much more then will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered Himself unblemished to God, cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death, so that we may serve the living God. For this reason, Christ is a mediator of a new covenant, that those who are called may receive the promised inheritance. Paul says in Romans chapter 3, that when Christ died on the cross, it was to finally, once and for all, to take care even of the sins of those people who lived under the old covenant, the first covenant. The blood of bulls and goats couldn't do that. It's almost as if every day when people sinned, then God allowed them by presenting the blood of bulls and goats to present a debit slip that promised payment someday. And God would accept that credit slip, that debit slip, against the account. And of course, what happens every day is the debt grows higher, gets larger. And God just keeps accepting a debit against it, a promise to pay someday. That's all those offerings of blood and bulls and goats were, a promise to pay someday. And then Jesus came. And suddenly someday was today. And He came and paid the debt that all the animal sacrifices never could pay. Not only paid the debts in the past, but the debts in the future, reaching right down to us today. There's a lot more to be said next week, because next week now we can, seeing that picture of the tabernacle and what was in it and what went on there, and then that was later replaced by the temple, which did exactly the same thing. We can now talk next week how Jesus was the reality that was casting that shadow back into the Old Testament on all those things.